and where every sculptor was judged by his ability to carve naked women. Where it was universally maintained that women do not have orgasms, and yet every prostitute was taught to simulate them. In some respects, the sexual mores of Victorian Britain replicated the mechanics of the age-defining steam engine. Blocking the flow of erotic energy creates ever-increasing pressure, which is put to work through short, controlled bursts of productivity. Though he was wrong about a lot, it appears Sigmund Freud got it right when he observed that civilization is built largely on erotic energy that has been blocked, concentrated, accumulated, and redirected. To keep body and mind untainted, explains Walter Houghton in The Victorian Frame of Mind, the boy was taught to view women as objects of the greatest respect and even awe. He was to consider nice women, his sister and mother, his future bride, as creatures more like angels than human beings, an image wonderfully calculated not only to dissociate love from sex, but to turn love into worship and worship of purity. When not in the mood to worship the purity of his sisters, mother, daughters, and wife, men were expected to purge their lust with prostitutes rather than threatening familial and social stability by cheating with decent women. 19th-century philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer observed that there are 80,000 prostitutes in London alone, and what are they if not sacrifices on the altar of monogamy? Charles Darwin was certainly not unaffected by the erotophobia of his era. In fact, one could argue that he was especially sensitive to its influence, inasmuch as he came of age in the intellectual shadow of his famous and shameless grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who had flouted the sexual mores of his day by openly having children with various women and even going so far as to celebrate group sex in his poetry. The death of Charles's mother when he was just 8 years old may well have enhanced his sense of women as angelic creatures floating above earthly urges and appetites. Psychiatrist John Bowlby, one of Darwin's most highly regarded biographers, attributes Darwin's lifelong anxiety attacks, depression, chronic headaches, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, and hysterical crying fits to the separation anxiety created by the early loss of his mother. This interpretation is supported by a strange letter the adult Charles wrote to a cousin whose wife had just died. "Never in my life, having lost one near relation," he wrote, apparently repressing his memories of his own mother's death, "I dare say I cannot imagine how severe grief such as yours must be." Another indication of this psychological scarring was recalled by his granddaughter, who remembered how confused Charles had been when someone added the letter M to the beginning of the word other in a game similar to Scrabble. Charles looked at the board for a long time before declaring, to everyone's confusion, that no such word existed. A hyper-Victorian aversion to, and obsession with, the erotic seems to have continued in Charles's eldest surviving daughter, Henrietta. Eddie, as she was known, edited her father's books, taking her blue crayon to passages she considered inappropriate. In Charles's biography of his free-thinking grandfather, for example, she deleted a reference to Erasmus's ardent love of women. She also removed offensive passages from The Descent of Man and Darwin's autobiography. Eddie's prim enthusiasm for stamping out anything sexual wasn't limited to the written word. She waged a bizarre little war against the so-called stinkhorn mushroom, Phallus ravenellii, that still pops up in the woods around the Darwin estate. Apparently, the similarity of the mushroom to the human penis was a bit much for poor Eddie. As her niece, Charles's granddaughter, recalled years later, "Aunt Eddie, armed with a basket and a pointed stick, and wearing a special hunting cloak and gloves, would set out in search of the mushrooms. At the end of the day, Aunt Eddie burned them in the deepest secrecy on the drawing-room fire with the door locked because of the morals of the maids."
"He will hold thee when his passion shall have spent its novel force. Something better than his dog, a little dearer than his horse. Alfred Lord Tennyson.
Don't get us wrong. Darwin knew plenty, and he deserves his place in the pantheon of great thinkers. If you're a Darwin basher looking for support, you'll find little here. Charles Darwin was a genius and a gentleman for whom we have endless respect. But, as is often the case with gentleman geniuses, he was a bit clueless when it came to women. In questions of human sexual behavior, Darwin had little to go on other than conjecture. His own sexual experience appears to have been limited to his vehemently proper wife, Emma Wedgwood, who was also his first cousin and sister-in-law. During his circumnavigation of the globe on the Beagle, the young naturalist appears never to have gone ashore in search of the sexual and sensual pleasures pursued by many seafaring men of that era. Darwin was apparently far too inhibited for the decidedly hands-on data collection Herman Melville hinted at in his best-selling novels Typee and Omu, or to sample the dusky South Pacific pleasures that had inspired the sexually frustrated crew of the Bounty to mutiny. Darwin was far too buttoned up for such carnal pursuits. His by-the-book approach to such matters is evident in his careful consideration of marriage in the abstract before he even had any particular woman in mind. He sketched out the pros and cons in his notebook. Marry and not marry. On the marry side, he listed children, if it please God, constant companion, and friend in old age, who will feel interested in one, object to be loved and played with. Better than a dog anyhow, female chit-chat, but terrible loss of time. On the other side of the page, Darwin listed concerns such as freedom to go where one liked, choice of society and little of it, not forced to visit relatives and to bend in every trifle, fatness and idleness, anxiety and responsibility. Perhaps my wife won't like London. Then the sentence is banishment and degradation into indolent, idle fool. Though Darwin proved to be a very loving husband and father, these pros and cons of marriage suggest he very seriously considered opting for the companionship of a dog instead. The Flintstonization of Prehistory. Judging from the social habits of man as he now exists is anything but a reliable method for understanding prehistory, though admittedly Darwin had little else to go on. The search for clues to the distant past among the overwhelming detail of the immediate present tends to generate narratives closer to self-justifying myth than to science. The word myth has been debased and cheapened in modern usage. It's often used to refer to something false, a lie. But this use misses the deepest function of myth, which is to lend narrative order to apparently disconnected bits of information, the way constellations group impossibly distant stars into tight, easily recognizable patterns that are simultaneously imaginary and real. Psychologists David Feinstein and Stanley Krippner explain, "Mythology is the loom on which we weave the raw materials of daily experience into a coherent story." This weaving becomes tricky indeed when we mythologize about the daily experience of ancestors separated from us by 20 or 30,000 years or more. All too often, we inadvertently weave our own experiences into the fabric of prehistory. We call this widespread tendency to project contemporary cultural proclivities into the distant past Flintstonization. Just as the Flintstones were the modern Stone Age family, contemporary scientific speculation concerning prehistoric human life is often distorted by assumptions that seem to make perfect sense. But these assumptions can lead us far from the path to truth. Flintstonization has two parents, a lack of solid data and the psychological need to explain, justify, and celebrate one's own life and times. But for our purposes, Flintstonization has at least three intellectual grandfathers, Hobbes, Rousseau, and Malthus. Thomas Hobbes, 1588 to 1679, a lonely, frightened war refugee in Paris, was flintstoned when he looked into the mists of prehistory and conjured miserable human lives that were solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. He conjured a prehistory very much like the world he saw around him in 17th century Europe, yet gratifyingly worse in every respect. Propelled by a very different psychological agenda, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, 1712 to 1778, looked at the suffering and filth of European societies and thought he saw the corruption of a pristine human nature. Travelers' tales of simple savages in the Americas fueled his romantic fantasies. The intellectual pendulum swung back toward the Hobbesian view a few decades later when Thomas Malthus, 1766 to 1834, claimed to mathematically demonstrate that extreme poverty and its attendant desperation typify the eternal human condition. Destitution, he argued, is intrinsic to the calculus of mammalian reproduction. As long as population increases geometrically, doubling each generation, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, etc., and farmers can increase the food supply only by adding acreage arithmetically, 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., there will never, can never, be enough for everyone. Thus, Malthus concluded that poverty is as inescapable as the wind and the rain. Nobody's fault, just the way it is. This conclusion was very popular with the wealthy and powerful, who were understandably eager to make sense of their good fortune and justify the suffering of the poor as an unavoidable fact of life. Darwin's Eureka moment was a gift from two terrible Thomases and one friendly Fred. Hobbes, Malthus, and Flintstone, respectively. By articulating a detailed, albeit erroneous, description of human nature and the sorts of lives humans lived in prehistory, Hobbes and Malthus provided the intellectual context for Darwin's theory of natural selection. Unfortunately, their thoroughly Flintstoned assumptions are fully integrated into Darwin's thinking and persist to the present day. The sober tones of serious science often mask the mythical nature of what we're told about prehistory. And far too often, the myth is dysfunctional, inaccurate, and self-justifying. Our central ambition for this book is to distinguish some of the stars from the constellations. We believe that the generally accepted myth of the origins and nature of human sexuality is not merely factually flawed, but destructive, sustaining a false sense of what it means to be a human being. This false narrative distorts our sense of our capacities and needs. It amounts to false advertising for a garment that fits almost no one, but we're all supposed to buy and wear it anyway. Like all myths, this one seeks to define who and what we are and thus what we can expect and demand from one another. For centuries, religious authorities disseminated this defining narrative, warning of chatty serpents, deceitful women, forbidden knowledge, and eternal agony. But more recently, it's been marketed to secular society as hard science. Examples abound. Writing in the prestigious journal Science, anthropologist Owen Lovejoy suggested, "The nuclear family and human sexual behavior may have their ultimate origin long before the dawn of the Pleistocene, 1.8 million years ago." Well-known anthropologist Helen Fisher concurs, writing, "Is monogamy natural?" She gives a one-word answer, "Yes." She then continues, "Among human beings, monogamy is the rule." Many different elements of human prehistory seem to nest neatly into each other in the standard narrative of human sexual evolution. But remember, that Indian seemed to answer Cortez's question, and it seemed indisputable to Pope Urban VIII, and just about everyone else, that the Earth remained solidly at the center of the solar system. With a focus on the presumed nutritional benefits of pair bonding, zoologist and science writer Matt Ridley demonstrates the seduction in this apparent unity. Big brains needed meat, and food sharing allowed a meaty diet because it freed men to risk failure in pursuit of game, and food sharing demanded big brains Without detailed calculating memories, you could easily be cheated by a freeloader. So far, so good. But now Ridley inserts the sexual steps in his dance. The sexual division of labor promoted monogamy, a pair bond now being an economic unit. Monogamy led to neotenous sexual selection by putting a premium on youthfulness in mates. It's a waltz, with one assumption spinning into the next, circling round and round in a spiral of comforting justification, proving how we came to be as we are. Note how each element anticipates the next, all coming together in a tidy constellation that seems to explain human sexual evolution. The distant stars fixed in the standard constellation include what motivated pre-human males to invest in a particular female and her children, male sexual jealousy and the double standard concerning male versus female sexual autonomy, the oft-repeated fact that the timing of women's ovulation is hidden, the inexplicably compelling breasts of the human female, her notorious deceptiveness and treachery, source of many country and blues classics, and of course, the human male's renowned eagerness to screw anything with legs, an equally rich source of musical material. This is what we're up against. It's a song that is powerful, concise, self-reinforcing, and playing on the radio all day and all night, but still wrong, baby, oh so wrong. The standard narrative is about as scientifically valid as the story of Adam and Eve. In many ways, in fact, it is a scientific retelling of the fall into original sin as depicted in Genesis, complete with sexual deceit, prohibited knowledge, and guilt. It hides the truth of human sexuality behind a fig leaf of anachronistic Victorian discretion repackaged as science. But actual, as opposed to mythical science, has a way of peeking out from behind the fig leaf. Charles Darwin proposed two basic mechanisms through which evolutionary change occurs. The first and better known is natural selection. Economic philosopher Herbert Spencer later coined the phrase survival of the fittest to describe this mechanism, though most biologists still prefer natural selection. It's important to understand that evolution is not a process of improvement. Natural selection simply asserts that species change as they adapt to ever-changing environments. One of the chronic mistakes made by would-be social Darwinists is to assume that evolution is a process by which human beings or societies become better. It is not. Those organisms best able to survive in a challenging, shifting environment live to reproduce. As survivors, their genetic code likely contains information advantageous to their offspring in that particular environment. But the environment can change at any moment, thus neutralizing the advantage. Charles Darwin was far from the first to propose that some sort of evolution was taking place in the natural world. Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, had noted the process of differentiation evident in both plants and animals. The big question was how it happened. What was the mechanism by which species differentiated from each other? Darwin was particularly struck by the subtle differences in the finches he'd seen on various islands in the Galapagos. This insight suggested that environment was crucial to the process, but until later he had no way to explain how the environment shapes organisms over generations. What is evolutionary psychology, and why should you care? Evolutionary theory has been applied to the body pretty much since Darwin published On the Origin of Species. He'd been sitting on his theory for decades, fearing the controversy sure to follow its publication. If you want to know why human beings have ears on the sides of their heads and eyes up front, evolutionary theory can tell you, just as it can tell you why birds have their eyes on the sides of their heads and no visible ears at all. Evolutionary theory, in other words, offers explanations of how bodies came to be as they are. In 1975, E.O. Wilson made a radical proposal. In a short, explosive book called Sociobiology, Wilson argued that evolutionary theory could be indeed must be applied to behavior, not just bodies. Later, to avoid rapidly accumulating negative connotations, some associated with eugenics, founded by Darwin's cousin Francis Galton, the approach was renamed evolutionary psychology, EP. Wilson proposed to bring evolutionary theory to bear on a few central questions of unspeakable importance. How does the mind work? And beyond that, why does it work in such a way and not another? And from these two considerations together, what is man's ultimate nature? He argued that evolutionary theory is the essential first hypothesis for any serious consideration of the human condition, and that without it, the humanities and social sciences are the limited descriptors of surface phenomena, like astronomy without physics, biology without chemistry, and mathematics without algebra. Beginning with sociobiology and On Human Nature, a follow-up volume Wilson published 3 years later, evolutionary theorists began to shift their focus from eyes, ears, feathers, and fur to less tangible, far more contentious issues such as love, jealousy, mate choice, war, murder, rape, and altruism. Juicy subject matter lifted from epics and soap operas became fodder for study and debate in respectable American universities. Evolutionary psychology was born. It was a difficult birth. Many resented the implication that our thoughts and feelings are as hardwired in our genetic code as the shape of our heads or the length of our fingers, and thus presumably as inescapable and unchangeable. Research in EP quickly became focused on differences between men and women, shaped by their supposedly conflicting reproductive agendas. Critics heard overtones of racial determinism and the smug sexism that had justified centuries of conquest, slavery, and discrimination. Although Wilson never argued that genetic inheritance alone creates psychological phenomena, merely that evolved tendencies influence cognition and behavior, his moderate insights were quickly obscured by the immoderate disputes they sparked. Many social scientists at the time believed humans to be nearly completely cultural creatures, blank slates to be marked by society. But Wilson's perspective was highly attractive to other academics eager to introduce a more rigorous scientific methodology into fields they considered overly subjective and distorted by liberal political views and wishful thinking. Decades later, the two sides of the debate remain largely entrenched in their extreme positions. Human behavior as genetically determined versus human behavior as socially determined. As you might expect, the truth, and the most valuable science being done in the field, lies somewhere in between these two extremes. Today, self-proclaimed EP realists argue that it's ancient human nature that leads us to wage war on our neighbors, deceive our spouses, and abuse our stepchildren. They argue that rape is an unfortunate but largely successful reproductive strategy, and that marriage amounts to a no-win struggle of mutually assured disappointment. Romantic love is reduced to a chemical reaction, luring us into reproductive entanglements parental love keeps us from escaping. Theirs is an all-encompassing narrative, claiming to explain it all by reducing every human interaction to the reptilian pursuit of self-interest. Of course, there are many scientists working in evolutionary psychology, primatology, evolutionary biology, and other fields who don't sign on to the narrative we're critiquing in these pages, or whose paradigms overlap at some points but differ at others. We hope they'll forgive us if it sometimes seems we oversimplify in order to more clearly illustrate the broad outlines of the various paradigms without getting lost in the weeds of subtle differences. Evolutionary psychology's standard narrative contains several clanging contradictions, but one of the most discordant involves female libido. Females, we're told again and again, are the choosy, reserved sex. Men spend their energies trying to impress women, flaunting expensive watches, packaging themselves in shiny new sports cars, clawing their way to positions of fame, status, and power, all to convince coy females to part with their closely guarded sexual favors. For women, the narrative holds that sex is about the security, emotional and material, of the relationship, not the physical pleasure. Darwin agreed with this view. The coy female who requires to be courted is deeply embedded in this theory of sexual selection. If women were as libidinous as men, we're told, society itself would collapse. Lord Acton was only repeating what everyone knew in 1875 when he declared, "The majority of women, happily for them and for society, are not very much troubled with sexual feeling of any kind." And yet, despite repeated assurances that women aren't particularly sexual creatures, in cultures around the world, men have gone to extraordinary lengths to control female libido. Female genital mutilation, head-to-toe chadors, medieval witch burnings, chastity belts, suffocating corsets, muttered insults about insatiable whores, pathologizing, paternalistic medical diagnoses of nymphomania or hysteria, the debilitating scorn heaped on any female who chooses to be generous with her sexuality, all parts of a worldwide campaign to keep the supposedly low-key female libido under control. Why the electrified, high-security razor-wire fence to contain a kitty cat? The Greek god Tiresias had a unique perspective on male and female sexual pleasure. While still a young man, Tiresias came upon two snakes entwined in copulation. With his walking stick, he separated the amorous serpents and was suddenly transformed into a woman. 7 years later, the female Tiresias was walking through the forest when she again interrupted two snakes in a private moment. Placing her staff between them, she completed the cycle and was transformed back into a man. This unique breadth of experience led the first couple of the Greek pantheon, Zeus and Hera, to call upon Tiresias to resolve their long-running marital dispute. Who enjoys sex more, men or women? Zeus was sure that women did, but Hera would hear none of it. Tiresias replied that not only did females enjoy sex more than males, they enjoyed it 9 times more. His response incensed Hera so much that she struck Tiresias blind. Feeling responsible for having dragged poor Tiresias into this mess, Zeus tried to make amends by giving him the gift of prophecy. It was from this state of blinded vision that Tiresias saw the terrible destiny of Oedipus, who unknowingly killed his father and married his mother. Peter of Spain, author of one of the most widely read medical books of the 13th century, the Thesaurus Pauperum, was more diplomatic when confronted with the same question. His answer, published in Quaestiones Super Viaticum, was that although it was true women experienced greater quantity of pleasure, men's sexual pleasure was of higher quality. Peter's book included ingredients for 34 aphrodisiacs, 56 prescriptions to enhance male libido, and advice for women wanting to avoid pregnancy. Perhaps it was his diplomacy, the birth control advice, or his open-mindedness that led to one of history's strange and tragic turns. In 1276, Peter of Spain was elected Pope John XXI, but he died just 9 months later when the ceiling of his library suspiciously collapsed on him as he slept. Why does any of this history matter? Why is it important that we correct widely held misconceptions about human sexual evolution? Well, ask yourself what might change if everyone knew that women do, or at least can in the right circumstances, enjoy sex as much as men, not to mention 9 times more, as Tiresias claimed. What if Darwin was wrong about the sexuality of the human female, led astray by his Victorian bias? What if Victoria's biggest secret was that men and women are both victims of false propaganda about our true sexual natures, and the war between the sexes, still waged today, is a false flag operation, a diversion from our common enemy? we're being misled and misinformed by an unfounded yet constantly repeated mantra about the naturalness of wedded bliss, female sexual reticence, and happily ever after sexual monogamy, a narrative pitting man against woman in a tragic tango of unrealistic expectations, snowballing frustration, and crushing disappointment. Living under this tyranny of two, as author and media critic Laura Kipnis puts it, we carry the weight of modern love's central anxiety, namely, the expectation that romance and sexual attraction can last a lifetime of coupled togetherness, despite much hard evidence to the contrary. We build our most sacred relationships on the battleground where evolved appetites clash with the romantic mythology of monogamous marriage. As Andrew J. Cherlin recounts in The Marriage Go-Round, this unresolved conflict between what we are and what many wish we were results in a great turbulence in American family life, a family flux, a coming and going of partners on a scale seen nowhere else. Cherlin's research shows that there are more partners in the personal lives of Americans than in the lives of people of any other Western country. But we rarely dare to confront the contradiction at the heart of our mistaken ideal of marriage head-on. And if we do? During a routine discussion of yet another long-married politician caught with his pants down, comedian social critic Bill Maher asked the guests on his TV show to consider the unspoken reality underlying many of these situations. "When a man's been married 20 years," Maher said, "he doesn't want to have sex, or his wife doesn't want to have sex with him. Whatever it is, what is the right answer? I mean, I know he's bad for cheating, but what's the right answer? Is it to just suck it up and live the rest of your life passionless and imagine somebody else when you're having sex with your wife the 3 days a year that you have sex?" After an extended awkward silence, one of Maher's panelists eventually suggested, "The right answer is to get out of the relationship. Move on. I mean, you're an adult." Another agreed, noting, "Divorce is legal in this country." The third, normally outspoken journalist P.J. O'Rourke, just looked down at his shoes and said nothing. Move on? Really? Is abandonment of one's family the adult option for dealing with the inherent conflict between socially sanctioned romantic ideals and the inconvenient truths of sexual passion? Darwin's sense of the coy female wasn't based only on his Victorian assumptions. In addition to natural selection, he proposed a second mechanism for evolutionary change, sexual selection. The central premise of sexual selection is that in most mammals, the female has a much higher investment in offspring than does the male. She's stuck with gestation, lactation, and extended nurturing of the young. Because of this inequality in unavoidable sacrifice, Darwin reasoned, she is the more hesitant participant, needing to be convinced it's a good idea, while the male, with his slam-bam-thank-you-ma'am approach to reproduction, is eager to do the convincing. Evolutionary psychology is founded on the belief that male and female approaches to mating have intrinsically conflicted agendas. The selection of the winning bachelor typically involves male competition. Rams slamming their heads together. Peacocks dragging around colorful, predator-attracting tails. Men bearing expensive gifts and vowing eternal love over candlelight. Darwin saw sexual selection as a struggle between males for sexual access to passive, fertile females who would submit to the victor. Given the competitive context his theories assume, he believed promiscuous intercourse in a state of nature to be extremely improbable. But at least one of Darwin's contemporaries disagreed. Lewis Henry Morgan. To white people, he was known as Lewis Henry Morgan, 1818 to 1881, a railroad lawyer with a fascination for scholarship and the ways in which societies organize themselves. The Seneca tribe of the Iroquois Nation adopted Morgan as an adult, giving him the name Tayadawaka, which means bridging the gap. At his home near Rochester, New York, Morgan spent his evenings studying and writing, trying to bring scientific rigor to understanding the intimate lives of people made distant by time or space. The only American scholar to have been cited by each of the other three intellectual giants of his century, Darwin, Freud, and Marx, many consider Morgan the most influential social scientist of his era and the father of American anthropology. Ironically, it may be Marx and Engels' admiration that explains why Morgan's work isn't better known today. Though he was no Marxist, Morgan doubted important Darwinian assumptions concerning the centrality of sexual competition in the human past. This stance was enough to offend some of Darwin's defenders, though not Darwin himself, who respected and admired Morgan. In fact, Morgan and his wife spent an evening with the Darwins during a trip to England. Years later, two of Darwin's sons stayed with the Morgans at their home in upstate New York. Morgan was especially interested in the evolution of family structure and overall social organization. Contradicting Darwinian theory, he hypothesized a far more promiscuous sexuality as having been typical of prehistoric times. The husbands lived in polygyny, i.e. more than one wife, and the wives in polyandry, i.e. more than one husband, which are seen to be as ancient as human society. Such a family was neither unnatural nor remarkable, he wrote. It would be difficult to show any other possible beginning of the family in the primitive period. A few pages later, Morgan concludes that there seems to be no escape from the conclusion that a state of promiscuous intercourse was typical of prehistoric times, although questioned by so eminent a writer as Mr. Darwin. Morgan's argument that prehistoric societies practiced group marriage, also known as the primal horde or omnigamy, the latter term apparently coined by French author Charles Fourier, so influenced Darwin's thinking that he admitted, "It seems certain that the habit of marriage has been gradually developed and that almost promiscuous intercourse was once extremely common throughout the world." With his characteristic courteous humility, Darwin agreed that there were present-day tribes where all the men and women in the tribe are husbands and wives to each other. In deference to Morgan's scholarship, Darwin continued, "Those who have most closely studied the subject, and whose judgment is worth much more than mine, believe that communal marriage was the original and universal form throughout the world. The indirect evidence in favor of this belief is extremely strong." Indeed it is. And the evidence, both direct and indirect, has grown much stronger than Darwin or even Morgan could have imagined. But first, a word about a word. Promiscuous means different things to different people, so let's define our terms. The Latin root is miscere, to mix, and that's how we mean it. We don't apply any randomness in mating, as choices and preferences still exert their influence. We looked for another term to use in this book, one without the derogatory sneer, but the synonyms are even worse. Sluttish, wanton, whorish, fallen. Please remember that when we describe the sexual practices in various societies around the world, we're describing behavior that is normal to the people in question. In the common usage, promiscuity suggests immoral or amoral behavior, uncaring and unfeeling. But most of the people we'll be describing are acting well within the bounds of what their society considers acceptable behavior. They're not rebels, transgressors, or utopian idealists. Given that groups of foragers, either those still existing today or in prehistoric times, rarely number much over 100 to 150 people, each is likely to know every one of his or her partners deeply and intimately, probably to a much greater degree than a modern man or woman knows his or her casual lovers. Morgan made this point in Ancient Society, writing, "This picture of savage life need not revolt the mind, because to them it was a form of the marriage relation and therefore devoid of impropriety." Biologist Alan F. Dixon, author of the most comprehensive survey of primate sexuality, called, unsurprisingly, Primate Sexuality, makes a similar point concerning what he prefers to call multi-male, multi-female mating systems, typical of our closest primate relationships, chimps and bonobos. He writes, "Mating is rarely indiscriminate in multi-male, multi-female primate groups. A variety of factors, including kinship ties, social rank, sexual attractiveness, and individual sexual preferences, might influence mate choice in both sexes. It is therefore incorrect to label such mating systems as promiscuous." So, if promiscuity suggests a number of ongoing, non-exclusive sexual relationships, then yes, our ancestors were far more promiscuous than all but the randiest among us. On the other hand, if we understand promiscuity to refer to a lack of discrimination in choosing partners or having sex with random strangers, then our ancestors were likely far less promiscuous than many modern humans. For this book, promiscuity refers only to having a number of ongoing sexual relationships at the same time. Given the contours of prehistoric life in small bands, it's unlikely that many of these partners would have been strangers. Chapter 3. A closer look at the standard narrative of human sexual evolution. We have good news and bad news. The good news is that the dismal vision of human sexuality reflected in the standard narrative is mistaken. Men have not evolved to be deceitful cads, nor have millions of years shaped women into lying, two-timing gold diggers. But the bad news is that the amoral agencies of evolution have created in us a species with a secret it just can't keep. Homo sapiens evolved to be shamelessly, undeniably, inescapably sexual. Lusty libertines, rags, rogues, and roues, tomcats and sex kittens, horn dogs, bitches in heat. True, some of us managed to rise above this aspect of our nature, or to sink below it, but these preconscious impulses remain our biological baseline, our reference point, the zero in our own personal number system. Our evolved tendencies are considered normal by the body each of us occupies. Willpower fortified with plenty of guilt, fear, shame, and mutilation of body and soul may provide some control over these urges and impulses, sometimes, occasionally, once in a blue moon. But even when controlled, they refuse to be ignored. As German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer pointed out, "Mensch kann tun, was will, kann aber nicht wollen, was will." One can choose what to do, but not what to want. Acknowledged or not, these evolved yearnings persist and clamor for our attention. And there are costs involved in denying one's evolved sexual nature, costs paid by individuals, couples, families, and societies every day and every night. They are paid in what E.O. Wilson called the less tangible currency of human happiness that must be spent to circumvent our natural predispositions. Whether or not our society's investment in sexual repression is a net gain or loss is a question for another time. For now, we'll just suggest that trying to rise above nature is always a risky, exhausting endeavor, often resulting in spectacular collapse. Any attempt to understand who we are, how we got to be this way, and what to do about it, must begin by facing up to our evolved human sexual predispositions. Why do so many forces resist our sustained fulfillment? Why is conventional marriage so much damned work? How has the incessant grinding campaign of socio-scientific insistence upon the naturalness of sexual monogamy, combined with a couple thousand years of fire and brimstone, failed to rid even the priests, preachers, politicians, and professors of their prohibited desires? To see ourselves as we are, we must begin by acknowledging that of all Earth's creatures, none is as urgently, creatively, and constantly sexual as Homo sapiens. We don't claim that men and women experience their eroticism in precisely the same ways, but as Tiresias noted, both women and men find considerable pleasure there. True, it may take most women a bit longer to get the sexual motor running than it does men, but once warmed up, Most women are fully capable of leaving any man far behind. No doubt, males tend to be more concerned with a woman's looks, while most women find a man's character more compelling than his appearance, within limits, of course. And it's true that women's biology gives them a lot more to consider before a roll in the hay. Comedian Jerry Seinfeld sums it up in terms of fire and firemen. The basic conflict between men and women, sexually, is that men are like firemen. To men, sex is an emergency, and no matter what we're doing, we can be ready in 2 minutes. Women, on the other hand, are like fire. They're very exciting, but the conditions have to be exactly right for it to occur. Perhaps for many women, libido is like the hunger of a gourmand. Unlike many men, such women don't yearn to eat just to stop the hunger. They're looking for particular satisfactions presented in certain ways. Where most men can and do hunger for sex in the abstract, women report wanting narrative, character, a reason for sex. But who would argue the gourmand takes less pleasure in her food than the glutton? In other words, we agree with many of the observations central to evolutionary psychology. It's the contorted, internally conflicted explanations for these observations that we find problematic. Still, there are simple, logical, consistent explanations for most of these standard observations concerning human sexuality. Explanations that offer an alternative narrative of human sexual evolution that is both parsimonious and elegant. A revised model that requires none of the convoluted mixed strategies and Flintstonizing intrinsic to the currently accepted story. The standard narrative paints a dark image of our species over a much brighter, albeit somewhat scandalous, truth. Before presenting our model in detail, let's take a closer look at the standard narrative, focusing on the 4 major areas of research that incorporate the most widely accepted assumptions. The relatively weak female libido, male parental investment, MPI, sexual jealousy and paternity certainty, extended receptivity and concealed or cryptic ovulation. How Darwin Insults Your Mother, the dismal science of sexual economics. What does the winning male suitor supposedly get for all his preening and showing off? Sex. Well, not just sex, but exclusive access to a particular woman. The standard model posits that sexual exclusivity is crucial because in evolutionary times, this was a man's only way of ensuring his paternity. According to evolutionary psychology, this is the grudging agreement at the heart of the human family. Men offer goods and services, in prehistoric environments primarily meat, shelter, protection, and status, in exchange for exclusive, relatively consistent sexual access. Helen Fisher called it the sex contract. Economics, often referred to as the dismal science, is never more dismal than when applied to human sexuality. The sex contract is often explained in terms of economic game theory, in which she or he who has the most offspring surviving to reproduce wins, because her or his return on investment is highest. So if a woman becomes pregnant by a guy who has no intention of helping her through pregnancy or guiding the child through the high-risk early years, she likely is squandering the time, energy, and risks of pregnancy. According to this theory, without the help of the father, chances are much better that the child will die before reaching sexual maturity, not to mention the increased health risks to the pregnant or nursing mother. Prominent evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker calls this way of looking at human reproduction the genetic economics of sex. The minimum investments of a man and a woman are unequal, explains Pinker, because a child can be born to a single mother whose husband has fled, but not to a single father whose wife has fled. But the investment of the man is greater than zero, which means that women are also predicted to compete in the marriage market, though they should compete over the males most likely to invest. Conversely, if a guy invests all his time, energy, and resources in a woman who's doing the nasty behind his back, he's at risk of raising another man's kids, a total loss if his sole purpose in life is getting his own genes into the future. And make no mistake, according to the cold logic of standard evolutionary theory, Leaving a genetic legacy is our sole purpose in life. This is why evolutionary psychologists Margot Wilson and Martin Daly argue that men take a decidedly proprietary view of women's sexuality. Men lay claim to particular women as songbirds lay claim to territories, as lions lay claim to a kill, or as people of both sexes lay claim to valuables, they write. Having located an individually recognizable and potentially defensible resource packet, the proprietary creature proceeds to advertise and exercise the intention of defending it from rivals. Baby, I love you like a lion loves his kill. Surely a less romantic description of marriage has never been written. As attentive readers may have noted, the standard narrative of heterosexual interaction boils down to prostitution. A woman exchanges her sexual services for access to resources. Maybe mythic resonance explains part of the huge box office appeal of a film like Pretty Woman, where Richard Gere's character trades access to his wealth in exchange for what Julia Roberts' character has to offer. She plays a hooker with a heart of gold, if you missed it. Please note that what she's got to offer is limited to the aforementioned heart of gold, a smile as big as Texas, a pair of long, lovely legs, and the solemn promise that they'll open only for him from now on. The genius of Pretty Woman lies in making explicit what's been implicit in hundreds of films and books. According to this theory, women have evolved to unthinkingly and unashamedly exchange erotic pleasure for access to a man's wealth, protection, status, and other treasures likely to benefit her and her children. Darwin says your mother's a whore. Simple as that. Lest you think we're being flip, we assure you that the bartering of female fertility and fidelity in exchange for goods and services is one of the foundational premises of evolutionary psychology. The Adapted Mind, a book many consider to be the Bible of the field, spells out the sex contract very clearly. A man's sexual attractiveness to women will be a function of traits that were correlated with high mate value in the natural environment. The crucial question is, what traits would have been correlated with high mate value? Three possible answers are as follows. The willingness and ability of a man to provide for a woman and her children. The willingness and ability of a man to protect a woman and her children. The willingness and ability of a man to engage in direct parenting activities. Now let's review some of the most prominent research founded upon these assumptions about men, women, family structure, and prehistoric life.
The famously flaccid female libido. The female, with the rarest exception, is less eager than the male. Charles Darwin.
Women have little interest in sex, right? Despite Tiresias's observations, until very recently, that's been the near-universal consensus in Western popular culture, medicine, and evolutionary psychology. In recent years, popular culture has begun to question women's relative lack of interest, but as far as the standard model is concerned, not much has changed since Dr. William Acton published his famous thoughts on the matter in 1875, assuring his readers, "The best mothers, wives, and managers of households know little or nothing of sexual indulgences. As a general rule, a modest woman seldom desires any sexual gratification for herself. She submits to her husband, but only to please him." More recently, in his now classic work, The Evolution of Human Sexuality, psychologist Donald Simmons confidently proclaimed that, among all peoples, sexual intercourse is understood to be a service or favor that females render to males. In a foundational paper published in 1948, geneticist A.J. Bateman wasn't hesitant to extrapolate his findings concerning fruit fly behavior to humans, commenting that natural selection encourages an undiscriminating eagerness in the males and a discriminating passivity in the females. The sheer volume of evidence amassed to convince us that women are not particularly sexual beings is quite impressive. Hundreds, if not thousands, of studies have claimed to confirm the flaccidity of the female libido. One of the most cited studies in all of evolutionary psychology, published in 1989, is typical of the genre. An attractive undergraduate student volunteer walked up to an unsuspecting student of the opposite sex, who was alone, on the campus of Florida State University, and said, "Hi, I've been noticing you around town lately, and I find you very attractive. Would you go to bed with me tonight?" About 75% of the young men said yes. Many of those who didn't asked for a rain check. But not one of the women approached by these attractive strangers accepted the offer. Case closed. Seriously, this study really is one of the best known in all of EP. Researchers reference it to establish that women aren't interested in casual sex, which is important if your theory posits that women instinctively barter sex to get things from men. After all, if they're giving it away for free, the bottom falls out of the market, and other women are going to have a harder time exchanging sex for anything of value. Male parental investment, MPI. As mentioned above, underlying each of these theories, as well as evolutionary theory in general, is the notion that life can be conceptualized in terms of economics and game theory. The objective of the game is to send your genetic code into the future by producing the maximum possible number of offspring who survive and reproduce. Whether or not this dispersal leads to happiness is irrelevant. In his best-selling survey of EP, The Moral Animal, Robert Wright puts it succinctly, saying, "We are built to be effective animals, not happy ones. Of course, we're designed to pursue happiness, and the attainment of Darwinian goals, sex, status, and so on, often brings happiness, at least for a while. Still, the frequent absence of happiness is what keeps us pursuing it, and thus makes us productive." This is a curious notion of productivity, at once overtly political and yet presented innocently enough, as if there were only one possible meaning of productivity. This perspective on life incorporates the Protestant work ethic, that productivity is what makes an animal effective, and echoes the Old Testament notion that life must be endured, not enjoyed. These assumptions are embedded throughout the literature of evolutionary psychology. Ethologist-primatologist Franz de Waal, one of the more open-minded philosophers of human nature, calls this Calvinist sociobiology. The female interest in quality over quantity is thought to be important in two respects. First, she would clearly be interested in conceiving a child with a healthy man so as to maximize the odds that her child would survive and prosper. Women's reproductive resources are precious and finite, and ancestral women did not squander them on just any random man, writes evolutionary psychologist David Buss. "Obviously, women don't consciously think that sperm are cheap and eggs are expensive," Buss continues. "But women in the past who failed to exercise acumen before consenting to sex were left in the evolutionary dust. Our ancestral mothers used emotional wisdom to screen out losers." Buss doesn't explain why there are still so many losers in the gene pool today if their ancestors were subject to such careful screening for thousands of generations. While a substantial amount of female parental investment is biologically unavoidable in our species, evolutionary theorists believe that Homo sapiens is uniquely high in male parental investment, MPI, among primates. They argue that our high level of MPI forms the basis for the supposed universality of marriage. As Wright puts it, "In every human culture in the anthropological record, marriage is the norm, and the family is the atom of social organization. Fathers everywhere feel love for their children. This love leads fathers to help feed and defend their children and teach them useful things." Biologist Tim Burkhead agrees, writing, "The issue of paternity is at the core of much of men's behavior, and for good evolutionary reasons. In our primeval past, men who invested in children which were not their own would, on average, have left fewer descendants than those who reared only their genetic offspring. As a consequence, men were and continue to be preoccupied with paternity." For now, we'll briefly note a few of the questionable assumptions underlying this argument. Every culture is organized around marriage and the nuclear family. Human fathers that provided for only their own children would have left far more descendants than those less selective in their material generosity. Note how this presumes a discrete genetic basis for something as amorphous as preoccupation with paternity. In the